Welcome to episode 4 of Keep Me Different, where we keep it different. Michelle, could you elaborate on your thoughts about universal income?
Yeah, I think I just don't see a way to solve the problem of lack of jobs after AI really takes off and tons of people's jobs are going to be replaced by machines and other automated features. You're going to have a high rate of unemployment. So I think a livable wage is probably the only way that we prevent like homelessness from increasing and just like people, if there's no jobs for people, like how will they make money? How will they survive? Like universal basic income is a really good idea in this situation because we are going to have people like not being able to find work. A lot of jobs that are like more, at least like the office jobs, a lot of those are going to get automated, especially if you're doing something that doesn't require a lot of like thought and it's more redundant and like repetitive, like they're going to automate those jobs. So what do those people do when they no longer have employment? We already have a homelessness issue in most of our major cities. So universal basic income can be like a stopgap for that, so that people, because if you were to like work at like, so for example, like instead of minimum wage, where we know that the average person can't even survive on minimum wage, there's been studies of that. There would be no minimum wage, there would be livable wage, where we would determine an amount that every place needs to live and function. So New York, it might be like 100K, right? Because isn't it like 100K to live in New York with like just baseline and be comfortable?
Yeah.
So it would have to be something like that so that there wouldn't be mass amounts of homelessness, mass amounts of unemployment.
But does it make sense though? I mean, we're trying to operate in a model that has never worked, right? It has never worked. And here comes AI to make sure it never works. Is it such a bad thing that AI is going to take the redundant jobs that require no thought? And just bear with me here when I say this. Because should one aspire just to work a boring job with no thought or no anything? If you look at it from a glass half full perspective, nah, nigga, this gonna force you to be creative, be your own boss, go create something and make something of your life, that something that you want to do, that you really enjoy, as opposed to you complaining, there ain't no jobs for us. Well, what jobs do you want? I want to be a checkout guy at the grocery store. What type of aspiration is that?
But what's the transition to get to that? Because I feel like a hard stop is like, that does nobody anything good. Until things are like in place and it's like, hey, this is going to happen maybe on this day or this is going to happen. I think right now it just feels like things are just popping up, happening, and then those that are left behind or stuck out in the cold is just stuck out in the cold, but there's no alternate route or there's no opportunity to take some time to then figure out what it is that you actually aspire to be.
Well, that opportunity is right now though, I think.
Yeah, but you've been so used to this role at, you know, the grocery store or wherever in this office behind this desk is like,
this is all you know.
Yeah. So like, how do you get out of that in the meantime while you're working to be
aspirational?
Yeah.
Do you think if people had that time, if some grand entity descended from the heavens and said, hey, I'm gonna give you a year to figure your shit out, what you want to do with your life, who you want to be, what your destiny is. After that year, some robots going to take your job at the checkout counter and you're going to be fucked. How many people do you think would really actually take advantage of that?
Well, think about a lot of the millionaires. They don't come until late 30s, 40s, going into 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had 25 to 30 years to figure it out.
Wait a minute, but those people probably worked high-paying jobs first, though.
Again, and then they were able to transition with some money in their pockets when they then figured out what they really wanted to do.
I mean, it's
but
easier.
They had that money though. Yeah. My mom used to work on Wall Street and now she works at Macy's for fun.
Exactly.
But she thinks that she needs the money though.
She's a what?
She works at Macy's for fun. She used to work on Wall Street. Oh. Both my parents. My dad does substitute teaching so that he has something to do.
But again, these are outliers. That's like somebody
that's
being
outliers.
Rich.
Yeah,
that's like somebody being rich telling you, hey man, money ain't everything.
But what I was saying with that is like, okay, if we're saying you have this time to do so, or these millionaires have money to then figure out what they want to do.
They do, the cushion.
So then what happens to the person that does not have money and we're trying to tell them, yo, try to find something that's more inspiring right now? It's like you don't even give them time or space to actually figure that out before they're out on the streets.
Yeah. Well, if you had the livable wage, that would like mitigate it, because then every job,
right?
Which, why is it not like this now? Every job that exists would be a livable wage.
Yeah.
Or people with handicap, you know.
Yeah.
That have to work jobs like that. That just, you know, that makes sense.
Well, disability is a thing. Is definitely something that would be challenging, because we don't protect disabled people currently in the U.S. Like, they're underemployed. Actually, the pandemic was really good for disabled people, because remote work created a market of jobs that were previously unavailable to people who could not like leave their house, and they actually could work for the first time. So remote work has been good for disabled people, but we'd have to figure something out with that too, because if some of the AI took away some of those remote jobs too, then, you know, disabled people would be struggling again financially, and we don't have great social safety nets in the US. So these are all things we'd have to think about.
So how could some of these things be implemented? Could they be implemented through the educational system? I mean,
I believe so. I think, you know, from my experience, even these last couple of years and looking at higher education, is that a lot of these students, and this is an MBA program that I'm teaching without an MBA degree.
I like that.
I like that you were able to finesse that.
Is that they're teaching or they're learning the same way that I was learning maybe like 15 years ago when I was going to college. Like, there's not much different of the information that's being shared, other than like more of like up to date situations and or scenarios around like business and things of that nature. And I'm only speaking from my experience, and you know, there's obviously programs out there and institutions out there and that are ahead and are leading the way, but it feels like a general sense when I start asking questions to other folks that have been in MBA programs or are teaching or going back, whatever it may be, it seems like the higher education in America is still very much of yesterday. You know, just as we've been innovative in other parts of our lives and society, is like, how are we innovating where it means the most or where it matters the most? And that's learning and like education. And I think it does start with like schools and programs to actually help get students, no matter, you know, child to then a young adult, understanding, you know, the new frontier of what's happening in the world.
When you were teaching classes, what did you witness that was lacking?
Man, for the most part, it was like even like some of the fundamental things.
Yeah.
Of like just being able to hold a conversation. Being able to like talk through and have a opinion.
Yeah.
Because I think that comes tough with just the pressures of society today. Is like, if you have an opinion, you may be looked at as crazy.
Yeah.
Or you don't know what you're talking about or whatever it may be. But like, just like the understanding of how things work in the workforce.
Yeah.
And how you do need to show up on time.
Yep.
You do need to actually be engaging. And this is the thing, like, engaging, you showing up and acing tests is something that you personally should be wanting to do. I shouldn't have to give you extra points for doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Like, showing up and getting good grades is like something that you should actually take on yourself to want to do. I shouldn't be incentivizing you to want to show up and have good grades.
So I've thoughts about that. I think we're witnessing a great disillusionment about education, because, and I'll say it too, I was definitely an overachiever growing up and got into a really top college, but for what though, right? Because like 100%. These jobs aren't paying, right? Yeah, yeah. So like people are like, why am I killing myself in school when I know the last group behind me are still unemployed or underemployed, right. Not making enough money to pay for their bills, all these things. So it's like,
well, I would say to that is like, so then why should I have to be the one as the professor teaching to then allow you to show up however you want to show up, but then it's on me to give you a good grade.
True. Yeah.
So do you think that there's a clash of ideology then? I mean, because this new group of people that you're teaching are like, why should I show up and do this when my predecessors, they struggling, living with their mom and dad. And you, coming from that old school mentality, is like, well, show up and work hard and
well, for me, here. It's not even an old school way of thinking. I think anybody that wants to be a professional has to show up and want to do good. Like, that sounds crazy to me that that's an old school way of, no, that's a way of thinking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
and this is an MBA program.
You're right, exactly.
Right,
so you're paying for this.
This is optional,
this
right?
Is optional.
No, for real. For the optional part, like, it should be different.
So could it just be antiquated then?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that's where we were getting to, or what I was getting to, is like just the higher education needs to be reconstructed as well. And like, get with the times of like what would make you want to actually show up, pay money to then send to class and want to do good, because then what's the end result or how can I apply it? Like for me, how I was teaching and what I wanted to make sure was we covered off on like critical thinking. So you actually really thinking through things and having a decision at the end of that and being good with that decision, whether it's right, wrong, or indifferent. And then how do you apply that to actually real life things?
Yeah.
Because for me, like, I've had this discussion with friends and family. Like, if you ask me, and I don't have any kids right now, but like, God willing, if I would want them to go to college, I would be like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Because what I've been able to experience and see, and to your point, what has college really done for some of these folks that still can't get jobs, that degrees don't mean anything? Mm. Like, I think trade schools are dope.
Yeah.
Because you're actually learning a skill, a tool. But if we're talking about just your prototypical kind of traditional college and how it's formatted today, I would question that. And I'm saying that as someone that's trying to at least understand more while doing their part in providing information for students to then take and hopefully apply it into real life.
Yeah, you know, when I think about it in its most basic sense, when I compare history, right? Now, history falls under the umbrella of something that happened in the past, right? Something that happened in the past. It could be 10 years ago, it could be a year ago, it could be a few minutes ago, it happened in the past. When I compare sitting in history class and being taught by my history professors, it's boring as fuck. But when I compare sitting next to my uncle and listening to him tell a story about when him and his friends got into a car chase when they was 17, 18 years old, it's extremely exciting. And the biggest difference is the delivery, the way the history was told to me, the manner in which it was told to me, right? It's still history.
Yep.
It's still the same family. But the antiquated, old way of teaching, I think, gets in the way of that when it's formal, right? 100%. When you're telling me a story about something, you're going to tell me a dope story, and it's going to be, you're going to be gesticulating it, your hands up, and then this motherfucker did it, and then I'll be engaged, right?
Right.
But then when it's like, Garen, now you're a professor, telling me that same story.
The great thing is, I carry myself the same way in any room.
Yeah.
So how I would share a conversation and story with you is the same way of how I would do it in a classroom.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if there's space for that as we know it today in higher education, of like allowing, and be honest, it's a lot of old retired folks as well that have learned a certain way that's teaching these classes, that you're not even having real-time professionals that are in the mix that are maybe
at a
high level.
That's an institution problem, because I feel like at NYU I studied journalism, and they did have professors that worked in the field recently, you know, so I felt like I loved college, like beyond the like debilitating workload and and being evaluated and the perfectionism, minus that part, right? Oh, but the learning I found very engaging. But I also picked a major that doesn't make any money, right? Yeah. Hey. And then also like is not, yeah, it's journalism. I also study African American studies. Like these are like non-lucrative right. subjects, but yeah. I found them fascinating yeah. and very engaging. If I had gone into something that made money, I probably would feel less engaged because it's like, all right, like that doesn't stimulate me, right? Yeah. So I think we are, because college costs so much money,
yeah.
we're all trying to get this like immediate return on our investment, right? And everyone wants to do like the 4 or 5 careers that pay high. And I think that also leads to like it being non-engaging too. For sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you a question. What made you go to NYU as opposed to a HBCU?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, okay, let me think. It's kind of like why I'm on this podcast probably, because I knew NYU had other kids like me, like unusual kids, kids that felt different, more eccentric, more free-thinking children or students. That was a big part of it. I wanted a place that was not going to be like the white suburbs I grew up in.
Yeah.
So I wanted like diversity. I wanted to be in New York City to like experience a completely different structure than like high school. And I think some colleges are just like high school part two with the campus and stuff. I actually wasn't bothered by there not being a traditional campus. So I wanted something untraditional. I do think HBCUs are cool. I love the heritage. I think I see the like family and the community vibe that people I know who went to HBCUs like, and the homecoming, that's definitely great. I think the one thing that held me or like prevented me from going there too is like, I knew the job world wouldn't be like that, where we're all just gonna be black and kicking it. Like I just knew that was not, cause I was living more like my upbringing in a white community. Sadly, that's kind of what it's like at most jobs, where it's mostly white people.
My little brother asked me that question.
Yeah.
I told him the same thing.
Mostly white people.
I said,
people,
man,
yeah.
the world ain't all black. You gotta experience all that. I don't know, in hindsight now, he actually said that to me. He was like, man, I took your advice. And he's a crazy successful lawyer. And just recently he said that to me. He was like, remember when you told me I should go to a school that's not HBCU because the world ain't all black? He's like, I wish I did listen to you. And for whatever reason, but he said he wished he didn't listen to me, if I'm not mistaken. But that makes
really?
Me,
he said he wished he didn't.
That he didn't.
I'm happy with my decision. I met cool ass black people though at NYU. It just wasn't like all black, but I met cool people from like all different races. Like, I don't know, it was a cool vibe. Yeah.
Well, my question to Garen, the reason why I asked you this is because I wanted to bounce this off you and bounce it on to Garen. So thank you, Michelle, for adding you for me. But why does a student or like Michelle have to escape to, I shouldn't say escape, but go to an NYU to find like-minded individuals? Why can't she find those same people at a HBCU?
That's a great question. I don't know if I'm a representative of HBCUs because I went to the University of Oregon, which is predominantly white.
I thought
white.
You went to Clark.
No.
I'm just kidding.
but I think, you know, I think we're all in the same, like, age bracket or whatever, that when I was even being recruited, like HBCUs and sports was even a thing. Like I don't think
there was a
focus on HBCUs now that you see today of like people actually really going to HBCUs and there being more access and understanding what HBCUs are, especially even coming from like with athletes and sports, is that all of the top sports schools or athletics are Division I, Big Five,
right.
now conference, traditional schools of the Michigans, the Texases, the USCs, and all cool. that. Is that if you as a competitor and an athlete wanted to compete at the highest level, you looked at going to one of those big schools to then showcase that, which then also puts you in the position to get drafted. I think that's has all shifted with NIL, the transfer portal, all of that other stuff, is that Now, if you're just a great player, you know, they'll find you.
Yeah.
And HBCUs for me, I think, would have been a dope experience if I had the opportunity to go, but it wasn't even on my radar when I was being recruited. Yeah. And I think for others, now I think it is on people's radar. It's like very more prevalent, I think, today than it was 10, 15 years ago. It was like, and I'm only speaking from my experience and maybe from the West Coast, because mm-hmm. we don't have many HBCUs. I don't think, are there
any on the West Coast?
HBCUs?
I think no, they're one. All on the East Coast.
That's what I'm saying.
Or the South, right? Yeah.
That is also probably a reason too. Why, as well, is like someone who's 17, 18, having to travel across the country to then go to school could be tough for a lot of folks that maybe not understanding what, you know, the opportunities that are there on their campuses.
Why is the NIL, and either of you please answer this, can answer this, why is the NIL such a threat?
Because it challenges everything that the establishment has created for college athletes.
What does NIL stand for?
So NIL is name, image, likeness. And for the longest, me as a college athlete would go to school. If I was on scholarship, I would get paid my room and board and a stipend for a month, or for monthly, sorry. And with that, we, you know, study hall, training, actual classes, tutors, practice, all that was kind of grouped into what you're signing up for. Come Saturday, jerseys are being sold with your number on it. People are tuning in to watch you play because of the athletes. There's a whole just marketing and business side of athletics that for the longest, no one cared to really highlight until the Ed O'Bannon case. I don't know if you guys...
Ed O'Bannon?
Yeah.
Of the O'Bannon brothers?
Yeah. So he was one of the first to actually call out the NCAA. I think that was in the 90s or something like that.
Yeah.
And then you fast forward, or the video games. Video games were being made. All types of shit was being created off the backs of athletes. And no one was really benefiting from that other than
the schools.
The schools and the coaches.
Yeah.
So now, 3 years ago, I think, 2020 or 2021, name, image, likeness came into play for the NCAA student athlete that they can get paid for just that, for their name, image, and likeness. And they could basically, they would be looked at as, even though they're not a professional athlete, but just how professional athletes get sponsorships, partnerships, different type of deals, can have an agent, all that, is like now student athletes have the opportunity for that. But there are like rules and regulations, state laws that different depending on what school you go to and all that. But for me, and why it's so refreshing to see, is that again, everyone benefited off of these athletes, but the athlete.
Yeah, the ticket sales, everything.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it took everything. Yeah. I want to say there's certain coaches that I could be wrong, so don't quote me on this, that get a percentage of ticket sales.
Oof.
Or something like that. You know what I mean? So that's bananas.
That's crazy. Especially if you like are a coach at like a Duke or UNC, you're making so much money.
Well, a lot of people argue that Nick Saban retired because of the whole NIL thing. Whether that's true or not, you know.
But the reason why, well, one, it's already here, and now people just have to adjust and change.
Yeah.
But why it's some are so against it is because a lot of these folks that were comfortable just on the day-to-day and not having to do much and still getting paid all this money now has to actually get back to work and actually recruit these kids and show them why they should come to the school that they want them to go to, on top of having to pay them as well. So it's like, as much as you were recruiting me, it's like I'm also now in the position to really decide where I want to go and what makes sense for me. Whether it's money and a financial short-term gain, which, you know, I can't knock anyone for that because their family may really need that, or if it's more of a long-term gain where it's like, hey, I'm getting paid this, but I also know this school is going to put me in a position to be successful 4 or 5 years down the road or whatever it may be.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I think for the last few episodes, overarching theme has been challenging the establishment, yeah. evolution, and growth. And, you know, going back to the very first episode when Michelle was talking about how, you know, black men traditionally, or men traditionally, you know, have had this image of what they're supposed to be, providers and whatnot. And now that women have caught up to them in the workforce and for like surpassed them, they're questioning what their roles are. I think we're at a crossroads. I think the way the world now, 2024, we're at a crossroads where you have to challenge all establishments and be willing to just grow, right? And evolve. Your favorite word.
You're challenging sleeve length.
I'm challenging what the length of a sleeve is. What is the length of a sleeve when you think about it? I want you guys to think about that. It's been another episode of Keep Me Different. Like, subscribe. And I want you all to sit home and think about how long your sleeve really should be.
And the shoes that you're wearing.
And the shoes that I'm wearing.